This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca. Here at CIFA Radio, we've been reporting on developments in the northern BC forestry industry, an industry which, by all accounts, is going through another state of transition. Things are changing. This is far from the first transition that the industry has gone through, but without having firsthand experience going through these various changes, it can be difficult for one to grasp the significance of what's happening now and how it compares to what has happened in the past. In a recent story, we attempted to grasp some of the significance of Sika's First Nation and the Municipal District of Vanderhoof collaborating on a forest management partnership, how that would affect local industry, and whether or not such a move could conceivably lead to mills reopening in the area. Would local partnerships like this compare to the large, but much smaller than publicly traded forest companies that populated the economic landscape of the past here in our region? Context and perspective really help in understanding these developments, and we were able to get a slice of just that from local entrepreneur John A. Brink, who is the sole proprietor of the Brink Group of Companies, which operates a real estate development branch, a warehousing and logistics branch, a media branch, and a lumber branch, which manufactures structural wood fused together from shorter pieces, creating a value-added product used primarily for construction. While the production of this product does not require the company to harvest directly from the forest, has been involved in our northern region's industry for decades. So buckle up for a bumpy ride as he recounts the growth rings that branch out through and past his entry into Canada, northern BC, and our regional forestry industry. Its evolution through technology, regulation, pine beetle infestation, trade disputes, and the progressive consolidation that has impacted the industry over the course of several decades, leading us into our current state of transition. We'll close with where Mr. Brink thinks we are headed in the near future. This, over two episodes, right here on CIFA Radio 88.7 FM's Due North. We take you now to part one of two.
Mr. John Brink, thank you so much for joining us at CIFA Radio today.
Yeah, nice to be here.
Excellent. People who may not be familiar with John Brink, do you want to describe who you are, the enterprise you operate a little bit?
Yeah, interesting, Ian. I've been in northern BC for 60 years. I came in from Holland in 1965. I was born in Holland, actually, in 1940. So in the next couple of months, I'm going to be 86 years young. And I grew up in a lumber environment. My grandfather was a master carpenter. My dad worked in the lumber industry. I worked in the lumber industry in Holland. Spent 2 years in drafted in the U.S. Air Force, actually, or in the Dutch Air Force as mandatory. And then when I was 24, I came to Canada. It was the dream. But two dreams, actually. The first dream was that we were liberated by the Canadian Army April 12, 1945. It made such an impression on me, having grown up during hunger periods, seeing far too much things that we should not have seen in a war setting, and we were liberated April 12, 1945, by the Canadian Army. It made such an impression on me that I knew from that point forward, as I grew up, I would go to the land of my heroes, Canada. And so the second one that I developed is not only going to Canada, but when I came here, and I had already studied on it, in particular timber and forestry, in particular British Columbia, I would go to British Columbia with the objective of building my own lumber mill. And so that's what I did. I arrived in Vancouver July 1965. It was recommended then that all the activity in the lumber industry and opportunity was in northern BC.
Head north, young man.
Yes, you know, and I came and they suggested, I could not speak English, didn't know a soul, didn't have a job. So at the immigration department, there was a German fellow that could speak a little bit of German. Told him I wanted to build a mill. He said, go to Prince George. Okay. That's where all the activity is.
Okay.
Summer of 1965.
Okay.
I did, came off the Greyhound bus here, and I had my suitcase, three books, two sets of clothes, counting my money. At least three or four times, I had $25.47. Right. And that's all I had, but I had the dream of building my own lumber mill.
Right, and I think that time period, you know, 1965, Motown music, you know, things leading up to the hippie revolution, all that kind of thing. You know,
All of that.
Yeah, all that is happening. But your goals were a little different. You were
correct.
Like, I'm going to start a mill, I'm going to be industrious, I'm going to head to Prince George, and I'm going to make something happen for myself.
Correct.
Okay, so... So that was around 1965, and then when you got to the area, when did you take on kind of like a management or ownership position? Or you
oh
know,
my goodness,
is that right
know.
Away?
No. Well, I had no money. I couldn't speak language. Didn't know how to sew, and didn't have a job. So you have to then with my $25.47. I wanted to start with nothing. That was the whole objective that I had, and so I got an opportunity to become a cleanup man with one of the larger mills in town. Company. Purely coincidental, called by the name of Netherlands Overseas Mills. I didn't know the ownership. I had no idea who they were. That's where I started as a cleanup man.
What are the chances of that? That's really funny.
Yeah, purely coincidental.
Right.
And then after I did that for a number of months, I was promoted to become a lumber piler. I did that part for 9 months. And then... The next thing was, it's always about, Ian, being noticed, being different. And I always, what I did, I always made sure I was before I started the job in the mornings. I was there 20 minutes before. I always stayed 10, 15 minutes after, got my workplace clean. And it was then a matter of time until they noticed me. The mill got into trouble, and they appointed a receiver. And they noticed me as somebody that had potential. So the first thing that happened to me then after my being on the green chain, they promoted me to back-end foreman. Back-end meaning as the mill, as the logs go into the mill, go through the main breakdown units, then to the edges, the back-end of the mill, I became a supervisor of that part. And did that for a period of time. And then when the mill got into trouble and reorganized, they promoted me to superintendent of the finishing side of the operation. So that's where it all started. That didn't go quick enough for me, even then. And so I had an opportunity to... I wanted to build my own mill, and I had to start with nothing, so that was a challenge. And so an opportunity presented itself where an individual came to me and said they have this little sawmill, and they want me to manage it.
Okay.
Where is it, is the question. In the Yukon Territory. Where in the Yukon Territory? Watson Lake. I said, okay, that's what I'll do. So... I drove to Watson Lake, and obviously for most of the people, we are in the center of British Columbia, 500 miles north of Vancouver, or 800 kilometers. Another 800 kilometers, 900 kilometers further north is the border of the Yukon and the BC.
And I'm going to guess that the road was not paved.
It was the Alaska Highway. And the Alaska Highway is all like this.
Switchbacks through the whole way, so it couldn't be bombed in a straight
and that
line.
Was the, and that was the reason for it.
Right.
And so I did that, went to Watson Lake, and it is the place. Can you imagine this fella coming from Holland? So it snows in July. You don't know if it is late or early. And then I've also seen it there, 62 below zero, something that I'd never been part of. And I was there for 5 years. Bought a number of other properties, was the largest owner of properties, bought a motel, and for just for a way of making money. and and then had a cabaret. I didn't even drink, but I had to make money in some form so I can buy a mill. And so then what happened, the bar business was pretty rough. It's all in my book. I'm also an author. I've written 5 books. The first one is Against All Odds. And, you know, there was a period in which in 1 year I nearly got killed 3 times in the bar, once by a knife and twice with a gun. And I knew my first daughter was born then in 1972. And I knew that if I stayed, I would not survive. So I gave it all away for $1, everything that I had in Watson Lake. Came back to Prince George, back to the company that I was involved with, then Netherlands Overseas. It became the cost accountant and then sales manager. And then in 1975, I had the idea of value-added manufacturing, developed a business plan, and then started at least an operation that was dormant, and then started experimenting with value-added manufacturing. So 52 years later now, I still do the same. I've since built 2 or 3 different sawmills, and obviously I've been very involved in the organizations of mills and all of that. So I'm still the owner of a number of companies. We have 4 silos. The one is lumber manufacturing. The other silo is warehousing, distribution, logistics, interior warehousing. I fully own that. The third one is real estate, residential, commercial, and industrial. And the fourth one is media. I'm an author. I'm working on my 6th and 7th book. Obviously, I'm a very active presenter and speaker. And then the other one, I'm probably one of the top podcasters in Canada. And globally, I'm 0.01% globally.
And roughly what year did you make that journey from interior BC here in Prince George up to Watson Lake, Yukon?
It must have been in about, I would think, 72. Gotcha. No, sorry, early 67.
Okay.
And then I stayed there till early 72.
So in that time frame, what was the scene like? You know, what did the competition look like in the forestry industry? Were there predominantly other similar-sized owner-operated forestry enterprises? And if so, you know, how far apart were these various businesses placed? You know, were they 1 kilometer from each other, all stacked down the road? Or were they a couple hundred kilometers away from each other?
Yeah, so let's just look at Watson Lake for a minute here.
Okay.
Watson Lake, beautiful timber, Liard Rivers there, mm-hmm. Not many manufacturing companies. And so in Watson Lake, lumber was a relatively small company. So that brings us to more where your interest is in the forest industry, northern British Columbia, and the coast of British Columbia as a whole. So at that point, I would say in 1965, and then even take us down further, Ian, into the late 40s, mid-40s, mid-50s, late 50s, around the Prince George area, where we are now, mm-hmm. there were in excess of 800 sawmills.
Wow. Wow.
And they were mainly small lumber manufacturers,
right,
that would get an allocation of timber, took their portable mills down there, cut rough lumber, put it on sticks, and then hauled it into town where it would go to the planer mills,
okay,
on Planer Road, which was located next to the Nechaco River. And that actually is the location where Brink Forest Products is right now.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Easily identifiable on the Millennium Trail on the side of the Nechaco River there.
Exactly. Yeah. And we were involved in developing that trail, actually. So we have the river there. We got the Planer Road, now called River Road. And then why were they located there with the planer mills? Because all the rough lumber came in from the different mills, maybe 1 truckload, maybe 2 truckloads, small loads on sticks.
For a quick explainer, this intermediate, roughly hewn lumber product went through that initial processing that Mr. Brink described while that lumber was still pretty green or fresh and loaded onto sticks, also known as stickering. So this practice is basically just throwing down small but uniform strips of scrap wood, probably less than an inch thick, down horizontally between the layers of stacked lumber. That allows air to travel between the stacked lumber, helps dry it out a little bit, but primarily delayed wood decay and structural warping, or twisting. In contemporary hardware store speak, you might hear people talking about dry stacking their wood. This is pretty much the same thing. If you've ever purchased a 2x4 or other piece of dimensional lumber, you may have noticed that some of the wood you get is nice and straight, while others can be kind of bent. Putting sticks down like this is pretty much the first step in preventing that from happening in the much longer process of making a finished dimensional lumber product, like a 2x4 or perhaps a larger wooden beam.
Loads, small loads on sticks, and they would try to sell the lumber to the planer operators that then would dry it, mainly outside, and then put it through their planer and put it all into boxcars.
Okay.
And as a mixture of different grades would go into boxcars. And so that is what the industry looked like
right.
from the mid-early 40s until well into the mid to late 50s.
Right. So the planers were kind of distributing things, you know, making a finished product, distributing. And when it comes to these,
they would then sell it mainly to the United States.
Okay.
As mixed loads and small boxcars.
Okay, gotcha. And these approximately 800 different companies, do you know roughly how many people would be working at a typical company? Obviously, that's going to range.
10 to 15, maybe.
Okay, gotcha.
So they would be harvesting the forest. They would be moving into a block.
So these aren't huge labor camps.
No, they're small operations.
Yeah.
They maybe make one truckload a week, and then they would sell it to the one that would pay them the most.
Right.
On Planer Road,
right.
now called River Road. And so there were a number of companies that were located at Planer Road that were doing well because they had the leverage in a lot of cases. They knew the market. They would have the planers, blah, blah, blah. And so they were making money. Then as the industry started changing, and again, look back at the mid-50s, and for those people that study it, look at the Sloan Commission, Royal Commissions, on restructuring the forest policies in the province of British Columbia.
Okay, folks, key detail. The term AAC is going to come up a lot in this conversation, and that stands for the Allowable Annual Cut. It was introduced around 1949 following recommendations from this 1945 Sloan Royal Commission on Forestry. This allowable annual cut is a maximum amount of timber that can be legally harvested from a specified area of public land each year in the province of British Columbia. The province's chief forester sets the AACs for timber supply areas, or TSAs, and tree farm licenses, TFLs, in accordance with Section 8 of the Forest Act. We, here in Prince George Clayley today, are in the Prince George Timber Supply Area. Sorry to disappoint you if you're hoping for a more creative name, like the Snuffleupagus Timber Supply Area, which does not exist, unlike the Snuffleupagus Forest Service Road, which does exist. The Prince George Timber Supply Area, as of July 2026, has an allowable annual cut of 6.9 million cubic meters. As of August 2026, Shane Berg is British Columbia's 18th chief forester, having been appointed in August of 2022. The chief forester is not elected, but essentially hired into that role as a nonpartisan individual who also holds a position of an assistant deputy minister within BC's Ministry of Forests. Their primary purpose is to act as a principal statutory decision maker for setting timber harvest levels throughout those 71 timber supply areas and tree farm licenses, and lead provincial forest stewardship. BC's first chief forester was Harvey Reginald, or H.R. McMillan. Originally from Ontario, he became BC's first chief forester in 1912. He switched jobs in World War I and then left to start his own company in 1919 called the H.R. McMillan Export Company Limited. And it sounds like he did well. That company was eventually consolidated into the forestry and paper giant known as McMillan Bloedel Limited, which in 1999 was acquired by the Seattle-based company Weyerhaeuser, which eventually sold its British Columbia operations for about $120 million in 2025 to the Gorman Group, a family-owned operation headquartered in West Kelowna, BC. What a legacy. We'll see how Shane Berg does. So, in case you didn't know these things existed, there's a little bit on what a chief forester and an AAC is.
There was a Sloan Royal Commission in 1945, and there was another one in 1955. And then there was another Royal Commission, there were being three, that was the Pierce Commission hearings in 1976.
All right.
So the interesting part then was that the forest industry evolved really from the coast inward. So the larger companies started developing down the coast, who then gradually moved further in to the interior. And mainly what they did is some of the mills would buy smaller lumber mills. I'm not talking about the Yukon now. I'm talking the coast. The coast would be typical Douglas fir, cedar, hemp fir, and those typical species, where the inland, Hope Forward, or Hope North, would have mainly lodgepole pine and spruce pine, balsam fir.
Gotcha.
That was typical for the inland landscape. And so gradually more timber licenses were issued, starting down at the coast. The reason that I'm so familiar with it, because A, I've been in the industry longer than anybody else virtually alive right now. And then the other part about it is that I'm writing a book about it and dealing with all the history of the forest industry in British Columbia.
Right. That's where the nitty-gritty details are going to be, right? And and you referenced this a little bit earlier in terms of volume. Like, you know, teams of these people would get together roughly a truckload a week. But, you know, what did harvesting really look like on the ground for these smaller operations? Like,
not good.
No. Like, today we talk in terms of cubic meters, right?
Yeah.
You know, when looking at volume of timber or fiber harvested. But it is not pretty. But what did it look like in action? What kind of volume were they producing? What was it like day to day?
Those were small operations. There were no debarkers or chippers. Right. They would have a head saw, then a ripper. So they would take the round log to cut the sides off and then put it into either 4, 6-inch, 8-inch, or 10-inch, and then put it through the edges. And then they would manually stack it, and that's what they produced. And it,
all that before it went on a truck and came into town.
Yeah, then it was rough. Mm-hmm. Then was put in on strips usually, so that it goes into town for drying. Other times it was not stripped, and it had to then be stripped here.
Gotcha.
There were no dry kilns then to speak of.
Okay.
For a quick elaboration, lumber kilns, not pottery kilns, that heat, harden, and cure pottery, but lumber kilns that carefully draw the moisture out of wood or lumber products, are now a common, and with a few exceptions, I dare say necessary part of bringing dimensional lumber products to market in today's world of various building codes and standardized building practices. Essentially, there are a number of ways, whether you want to use a heated radiator or microwave radiation or solar heat or whatever method, to draw a certain amount of moisture content out of the lumber you intend to sell so that it does not rot, crack, or warp out of the dimensions a lumber mill, sawyer, planer, or lumber processor has worked that wood into. If you really want us to do a show on different types of lumber kilns, reach out to newsroom@cfer.ca and we'll see what we could do.
There were no dry kilns then to speak of. So that became later, right. You know, so later meaning early 60s. And so what happened in the early 60s, and again, what I always do, Ian, is saying so that for our listeners, we can spend a whole lot of time talking about the coast, meaning Hope South, or we can talk about the interior, mm-hmm. meaning north of Hope up to the Yukon border. The Yukon already, we discussed, relatively minor in the scope of things. But then what happened is that smaller mills started developing in the 40s here, and they started consolidating gradually. And then smaller mills became a little bit larger, very gradual.
if we circle back to the era of early 70s, perhaps into the 50s, when a harvesting area became depleted after, you know, a mill was operating there for a bit, what was the steps that followed? Was reforestation or replanting part of it at that time? Did the company apply for permitting before harvesting elsewhere? Were, you know, taxes applied, that kind of thing? And did the mill operation have to then pack up, move to a new area, or would it ship things over to where it was?
Okay, so even in the 60s and in the 70s, there was tenure.
Okay.
That means volume-based tenure, not area-based tenure. So that where the mill was allowed to harvest, after they got permits for a particular region, a volume of tenure that was equal to the tenure rights that they had accumulated. So that's the one.
And tenure is related to annual allowable cut or AAC.
Correct.
And all through the ladder.
Correct.
Of...
Correct.
Permissions.
And so more normally it's around 60 million cubic meters, so it's, well, pretty much predictable. So they have tenure, they may buy other additional fiber on the open market. So that's was kind of the way it was. Now, the other part about it is in those years that the ministry in British Columbia, the Minister of Forest would manage all the replanting.
Okay.
That didn't work well. Up to 1986, when the government changed a new policy that changed forest policy dramatically, where the mills were obligated to replant. We were far behind in planting. So very quickly, when it was given to industry as an obligation, it was replanted. So now we have... managed by the forest companies, replant as much for every tree that we knock down, we replant three. So hence, it has served us well, even under the circumstances, where the Bowron River, there was a spruce beetle pandemic. If you go there today, it's amazing how we have regrown the forest. So, and for the people watching us, it takes maybe... depending on where you are, if you're in our region, it takes about 40, 50, 60 years to regrow. And the further north we go, the more higher it goes. You know, so it may be 80 years in the Fort St. John area, something like that. But do we have good ground and good ability? Yes, we do.
Okay.
Smaller mills started developing in the 40s here, and they started consolidating gradually. In the early 60s, smaller mills became a little bit larger, very gradual, and then something else happened. In the early 1960s, there was a change to forest policy that for the intent of, and again, changes to forest policy of what had happened, our listeners would find it interesting, is that a number of individuals in the industry found that in Alberta they were planning to build pulp mills.
Okay.
And then chip the residuals and then put them through that, like what we know now.
For a quick explainer, so that time period was the early beginnings of a scene we're much more familiar with now in the forest industry of British Columbia. A pulp and or paper mill does not typically accept raw logs to make its pulp products. Before any wood product enters the digestion or chemical cooking process inherent in a typical pulp mill, the wood has to be processed a bit. What's fairly common now is for a sawmill to accumulate leftovers, trimmings, edgings, little slabs, and those are all cut up into chips, wood chips. Not necessarily sawdust, but little chunks that have an approximate length and width of 2.5 centimeters and probably only 4 millimeters thick. That way, chemical and steam can penetrate them more easily and evenly. Then the sawmill facility transports those chips over to a pulp mill, maybe using a fleet of chip hauling trucks, or depending on how well they're set up, rail cars, maybe even direct conveyor belts, depending on the size of the facility. Then, of course, screening, washing, and grading happens. And, of course, a series of screening, washing, and grading happens before those chips make it into a chemical digestion process for those wood chips to be turned into pulp. During the time period Mr. Brink talks about here, the systematized process was in its very early stages in our province.
So then the movers and shakers in this region suggested that we should make a proposal to the Minister of Forest and others that we should try to attract pulp mills here in Prince George. Early 1960, a study was suggested should be done to show how much of the timber harvested was really turned into lumber. You know the amazing thing is that people did not fully understand? It was less than 25%. 25% or less.
Right.
So that meant then there were lots of additional residuals. How then do you attract capital? So what they needed to do is do a study to put that into a document form by a credible outfit. So the credible outfit then already was IFS, Industrial Forest Service.
Oh.
It's already still here. Rob Schutz is now the CEO, but then other ones were there already in the early 60s.
Right. IFS is a very familiar company here in Prince George.
That's Industrial Forestry Service Limited, a consulting firm focusing on natural resources, primarily forestry. Established in 1952, they operate a forest nursery out at Ness Lake, have an office building in downtown Prince George, and as Mr. Brink says, operate all over the province.
Yeah. Exactly. Not only in Prince George, in the whole region and beyond. So it was estimated that the cost would be of doing the study would be $200.
That's it? $200.
Yeah. Nobody wanted to do it. Too much money. Think again, early 60s.
Okay. All right. Yeah, inflation has taken place since then.
Yeah. somewhat. Anyway, so IFS offered to do it for free.
Okay.
And they did. And the result was precisely what I said earlier, that maybe 25% of the logs being cut and processed would be turned into lumber. And so that was really troubling, obviously. So with that particular study, they went down to Northwood Noranda then and others, and then the predecessor of Canfor. They started Intercontinental as well as Prince George Pulp.
Gotcha.
Two pulp mills.
Noranda is a name of a local Forest Service road as well in the area.
It's in Eastern Canada then.
These names are all coming into place on the map for me.
Yeah. So those were the ones that built the pulp mill, but now known as Northwood Pulp.
Gotcha.
And so that was in the mid-60s. But the other part that happened to forest policy into the smaller operators that had the smaller little mills, that there had to be a policy clause called close utilization, meaning you could not leave the residuals behind. You had to have turned them into chips.
Okay.
And that was a commitment made to the investors in the pulp mill, that it would be mandatory to do that, which created an availability of chips.
Right.
So they did that, and that pretty much puts out of business most of the smaller mills in the bush because they could get no timber unless they had debarking and chipping ability.
So at that period of time, a lot of small businesses would just simply not be able to take on the extra equipment and extra labor required to then take advantage of those extra residuals.
To invest in debarking and chipping would far exceed the value of the mill, by far. You had to totally rebuild the mill.
Right.
And a lot of people could not do that.
Was that kind of the aha moment that you had where you started seeing that just smaller scale owner-operated enterprises were on their way out for good, and larger entities would ultimately outcompete all these smaller players to eventually, you know, dominate the forestry industry in a setting we're more familiar with today?
Correctly so.
Okay.
So but consolidation became more and more of an issue.
In retrospection, when the policies came into place that encouraged industry to take advantage of something closer to the whole tree instead of just using 25% of the tree for a lumber product, and industry started consolidating into larger and larger entities, How did you adapt to that changing economic landscape? Where was your moment where you thought, how can I make my way through this and get to the other side of it? What was going through your head at the time, and what was your conclusion?
Yeah. So obviously I did not have the money to buy somebody's mill. Right. So I had to find an operation that was dormant on Plano Road, actually, a river road.
Approximately what year would have that been?
That was 1975.
Okay.
And then I was relying on sawmills. And if a sawmill manufactures products, if it is 100% of projects, the top 25% is high grades. The bottom 25% is low grades, not suitable for structure. And so I would focus on that bottom 25%. Buy it, further remanufacturing, take out the good wood. But the problem with it was that a lot of small pieces were developed. And I had been exposed to finger jointing, gluing small pieces together. And everybody said, oh, that will never work here. So I did, and I still do that today.
Right.
So I look at them, how can we be complementary to the primary sector? Obviously, we've been affected because 50% of the primary sector has shut down or does no longer exist, yeah. And access to fiber is more difficult for us. But I'm still in business.
Yeah, and you were part of that secondary manufacturing process, the right. value-added area.
Yeah, and I've always been part of that. I was the founding president of the BC Council Value-Added Wood Processes. I believe we have to add more social and economic value to our resources.
Understood.
And so consolidation became more and more of an issue, more and more and more and more, even to the extent that in 1955, H.R. McMillan, who was the first provincial forester when he was 27 years old, I think it was in 1917, and who became the chair of McMillan Bodell, suggested that the consolidation of lumber manufacturing would dominate the industry, and at some point, likely, it would be not to the benefit of the province and the crown.
Gotcha. Yeah, so you recall H.R. McMillan, who's appointed as a province's chief forester at the age of 27 after obtaining a Master of Science degree in forestry from Yale, later becoming a renowned industrialist. Well, that might make you ponder your own life decisions or where a master's degree in science could take you today. Regardless, this individual could see the shape of things to come as companies consolidated into progressively larger and larger entities. This, coupled with pulp mill technology being introduced into Western Canada, associated regulations, a pine beetle infestation that shocked the industry, and ongoing trade disputes with Canada's largest trading partner, the United States of America, all contributed to the current state of the forest economy influencing our region. Mr. Brink saws into that log in part two. So concludes part one of two in our interview with John A. Brink, local entrepreneur and proprietor of the Brink Group of Companies, including Brink Forest Products Limited. Join us in part two as we continue to tap Mr. Brink for his perspective on how the industry has changed over time and what sort of scenario players can expect in the current forestry industry landscape and into the future. This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca.